You ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Barry Gurk. I'm local counsel for the plaintiff below, Pablo Urena, and I'm pleased to introduce to the court Mark J. LeWinter. He is a partner in the Philadelphia law firm of Annapol, Schwartz, Weiss, Cohan, Feldman, and Smalley. Mr. LeWinter has been admitted pro hoc vici in the court below and this court. He will argue the cause today for plaintiff. Mr. Crumpler is counsel for Delaware Trial Lawyers Association and is amicus, and no time will be reserved for amicus argument.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. LeWinter.
May it please the court, Justice Steele, Berger, and Richley. This case essentially involves two issues before the court. And those two issues are whether the evidence in this case was sufficient to create a factual issue as to whether Capano voluntarily assumed a safety duty and whether it was error to grant summary judgment. Second issue is whether the lower court's reliance on Willingham was misplaced when it granted summary judgment on the 411 negligent hiring claim, overruling what had been longstanding precedent in the state. With regard to the voluntary assumption of safety in this particular case, there is essentially three separate areas, or indicia, if you will, where there are factual questions raised as to whether or not Capano assumed a responsibility for safety on this job site. It is true that this was a project owned by Muirfield, which Mr. Capano owned 99% of, and his wife owned the other percent. He, in effect, contracted with himself, the Capano Homes entity, and in doing so, the contract was silent with regard to safety. However, Mr. Capano, as well as his superintendent, conceded. They admitted in deposition testimony that they shared a responsibility with the subcontractor with regard to OSHA, compliance with OSHA, and a safe work site. So absent any sort of an express contract, they admitted that they had that responsibility, and they accepted that responsibility.
Can we start with what it is that gets voluntarily assumed that allows for liability to be imposed? You've just referred to safety. And the quotation from the case law that the trial judge relied upon was, undertakes responsibility for implementing the required safety measures. Isn't there a difference between those two phrases?
Yes, I believe there is. And the critical issue in these cases becomes, are we dealing with just superintendents to ensure compliance with the contract, or does it go beyond just superintendents and supervision, and does it go to enforcement? And I think, yeah, Your Honor, the real issue becomes that if it's just mere superintendents, arguably those are not facts that would support a voluntary assumption. But when the conduct of the general contractor moves into forcing compliance, then it becomes a different situation. The facts in this case were that Mr. Chambers, who was the job site foreman, was deposed, and Mr. Chambers stated that before Rising Sun was hired on this project, the Martin roofers would routinely ignore their safety responsibility, and Chambers stated that the only way that he could get them to comply was to basically jump up and down, and finally they would comply. He had to force compliance. He had to basically tell them to use it, and then they did.
Well, by telling them, is that going to the people on the roof and talking to them directly, or does it turn on that, or as opposed to talking to their supervisor?
I think it goes to the totality of the circumstances. Some of these cases will hinge on some facts, whether you speak to the foreman or whether you're actually speaking directly to the workers. But when you look at the global circumstances of a case,
so what is the rule? Or is there one?
Well, I don't think there's a hard rule. I think that this court has routinely looked at the overall circumstances at the work site and has looked to see whether there are various indicia of assumption, and it's a question of fact. These cases are all fact driven. In a situation where you have Mr. Chambers basically forcing compliance. And in this case, the safety policy, the Capano Home safety policy, which is in the record, has a provision in it that says Capano Homes is responsible for having a representative that can enforce compliance with OSHA. In some of the cases previously, it's merely pointing out omissions or OSHA violations does not rise to the level of voluntary assumption. But when that contractor continually ignores their responsibility, it becomes incumbent upon the general contractor to ensure compliance by forcing it. The issue that I'll be arguing next is really interrelated when we talk about negligent selection, because if the general contractor hires a competent contractor, the less likely it is they'll have to be proactive on the job site because the contractor understands its obligations and works safely. The converse of that is also true. If a general contractor is negligent or is reckless in their hiring, they hire someone that basically flouts safety and just ignores safety, then they're going to have to be more proactive and ensure compliance. So in this particular case, the facts of record that created a question of fact were that with a prior contractor, there was evidence that Mr. Chambers had forced compliance, had done this on more than one occasion. Now, Mr. Chambers, with regard to Rising Sun, said, well, I didn't have authority to do it with Rising Sun. I could only go to my superior, which was Mr. Worrell, and say to Mr. Worrell, they're not listening to me. The facts in this case are that he did that. He went to Mr. Worrell. That's the super, one of the higher-ups, one of Mr. Capano's right-hand men, and basically Mr. Worrell said he'll take care of it. Mr. Worrell didn't take care of it. The contractors continued to work in violation of OSHA. He then went back to Mr. Worrell a second time. Mr. Worrell said again that he would take care of it, and he never did. The point is that there was demonstrated by Capano in this case, certainly by experience with that prior roofer, a need to be more proactive when they obviously hired a contractor that wasn't listening to them. They had that responsibility. They demonstrated by their prior conduct that it was necessary when it wasn't taken care of. You have a question of fact raised by those factors, and it was error for the court to dismiss this case and really take that issue away from the jury. This question of voluntary assumption has always been a mixed question of law and fact. It's obviously a question for the court to decide, but sometimes there are factual issues that need to be played out, and sometimes the jury needs to make certain determinations. But in this case, there was no opportunity to do that. And in this case, by their conduct and by their statements, certainly by evidence of the safety policy, there was more than just mere general superintendents.
Could you kind of list the evidence that supports your position? You're saying that there were two contacts where safety problems were reported to Capano's right-hand man, right?
That's correct.
And where the response was, I'll take care of it.
That's correct.
What was it that was being asked to be taken care of?
What had occurred was that the Rising Sun subcontractor, they were basically ignoring requests to use fall protection and working without it. So specifically what Mr. Chambers said to Mr. Worrell is, they're not listening to me when I tell them to use their safety harnesses. And Mr. Worrell's response was that he would take care of it. In other words, get in touch with the contractor and make it happen.
And the person who was complaining was
the job site foreman for Mr. Capano, Mr. Chambers. He was vested with the responsibility of supervising the site and making sure that it was a safe workplace and that these workers were working in compliance with OSHA and within the contract. But Mr. Chambers, like I mentioned, with a prior roofer who was fired because they weren't working fast enough, demonstrated not only his responsibility to do it, but he demonstrated the capacity for enforcement because he actually had forced them to use it at times, and when he did, they complied.
Okay, so there were two contacts by Mr. Chambers. What else is evidence, in your view, of Capano's undertaking responsibility for safety?
There is a safety policy, Your Honor, and that safety policy, which ironically was prepared by an insurance company, on the record on page 345, had a management safety policy statement. And in that statement, it placed the responsibility of Capano, placed on Capano the responsibility for having personnel on site to enforce safety, not just to supervise it, but to enforce it.
Okay, and what else, if anything?
Just the admissions in this case, in the record on page 176, the admissions by Chambers and by Mr. Capano acknowledging that they had a responsibility, a shared responsibility with the subcontractor for safety.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Are there other, you know, important pieces of evidence that bear on this?
No, I think I've summarized
the
key.
What I'm wondering about is this. It's good that Capano has a safety policy in place and that there was a person on the job site who was concerned about making sure that the subcontractors were acting appropriately. But if that's enough to impose liability on Capano, then haven't you described pretty much the way every workplace operates? I mean, doesn't the general contractor always take a look around and supervise and make sure that the subcontractors are doing what they're supposed to be doing, including operating safely? Where would the line be drawn? How could you not have undertaken an obligation to provide safety under your approach to it?
I think at least the line that I've seen drawn in these cases is where, assuming that a competent contractor is hired, one that's working in compliance with their contract and with OSHA, the general contractor may point out to that subcontractor that they're in violation of OSHA, and they correct it. There's no need for the general contractor to continually have somebody there enforcing it, and if necessary, throw them off the job. What happens in these cases is you have a contractor, in this case like Capano, that understood the responsibility, recognized that it wasn't being done, and basically turned his back on that and looked the other way. And that's what happens in job site after job site, and that's why, certainly within residential construction, there's a huge problem. It's routinely done by subcontractors in various tiers, and unless the captain of the ship or unless Capano, who is building this project, enforces safety, it's got to be from the top down, not bottom up. So to answer your question, again, it's tied in with hiring a competent contractor. To the extent that a competent contractor is hired, there's less need for Mr. Capano or any general contractor to be forcing compliance. To the extent that it doesn't happen, you can't look the other way and allow these workers to be exposed to catastrophic injury and death.
So what you're saying is that there should pretty much be a blanket rule that the general contractor is going to be responsible for the employees of the subcontractor's safety.
I think that there should be a rule that the general contractor is responsible for ensuring and enforcing OSHA compliance. That is correct. If the subcontractor does not do it, the subcontractor should be fired or the subcontractor should be forced to comply. But it's not acceptable to have the general contractor look the other way. Which is what happened here.
Isn't the current law that responsibility falls on the general contractor when the facts establish that he's voluntarily assumed that duty in the absence of a contractual obligation to perform that duty? And this case turns on whether there's evidence that the general contractor in this situation did, in fact, voluntarily assume the duty.
I would agree with Your Honor. And I think the evidence that I have suggested is admissions by these workers that they understood they had that responsibility, even if Capano didn't contract with himself.
And that would, in effect, be practical in the sense that there would be circumstances under which you wouldn't want a bright line rule because the general contractor or his representative is not always on the job site, and there might be some practice going on by a subcontractor that's unsafe, whether it's an OSHA violation or not, and the general doesn't want to take responsibility for what he doesn't know is happening or has no control over because it occurs within a short window of time. But on the other hand, if he has a superintendent there who
interjects himself into an observation that there's a violation and fails to enforce it, either by pulling the subcontractor off the job, if going to the subcontractor's principal first doesn't work, pulling the employees off the job until that violation is corrected, then he's voluntarily assumed the responsibility for it.
That's correct. That's correct.
That's not inconsistent with Handler, is it?
I don't see that it is.
The only difference between Handler and this fact situation is the extent to which there's evidence that the general contractor voluntarily assumed a supervisory duty or responsibility for safety on the job site.
Again, you know, a fact-driven determination that oftentimes will have to be made as the court, as the case progresses. We never had a chance to take it that far.
But it's your position that summary judgment is incorrect here because there were material issues in dispute, genuinely in dispute, about the extent to which the contractor had assumed that safety responsibility, correct?
Absolutely.
Some of the evidence that you've discussed was not in the trial judge's summary judgment opinion, is that right? Or was all of it in there?
I believe that's correct. I think that safety policy was not referenced.
And is that because it was developed later in the course of discovery, or was all that presented to the judge and just not commented upon?
I know we had mentioned the policy. I'm not sure if that specific provision was brought to the court's attention. I honestly don't recall that. What I do recall is that the key testimony with regard to Chambers and with regard to Worrell, with regard to the conduct demonstrated with Martin, which is not irrelevant, that is the same job site and it's the same hazard, and they addressed that problem with Martin, and they could have addressed it in the same way with Capano. That was all brought to the court's attention, but I just don't recall about that one phrase in that policy. The second issue, briefly, was whether this court should affirm the holding that would bar a 411 claim for negligent hire. And simply our position is that the judge's reliance on Woolahan was misplaced. Woolahan, of course, dealt with a landowner liability, dealt with Section 343, an asbestos case, and whether it was unreasonable to make a landowner responsible for unsafe work practices solely because the work's taking place on his property. We don't quarrel with that. This case, though, involves Capano, and he's a sophisticated and experienced contractor who regularly hires subcontractors as part of his business, and he's being sued for the hiring of such a contractor.
Well, the restatement refers to an employer, right, under 411?
Under 411, the term is really employer of an independent contractor, not literally in terms of an employer-employee relationship. The restatement 411.
My point is, would the average homeowner who's hiring somebody to redo their roof have to research the safety record of that contractor?
No.
In case someone falls off the roof?
No, and again, what I'm trying to distinguish is we're dealing here under these facts in the application of 411 with a sophisticated general contractor in the building business that hires these contractors as part of his duty.
I understand the factual point you're making, but what is the rule of law?
The rule of law that I'm urging this court to basically adopt is what's been the law in the state for the past 15 years, and that is that there is a duty incumbent upon a general contractor to make reasonable efforts to hire a sub, and that duty is owed to employees of the independent contractor. That has been the law in the Superior Court, and has been the law in the federal court, and that was the law that was reversed in effect by the trial court in this case. I would submit to you that certainly in the facts of this case, all you have to do is ask a contractor like Mr. Moonsock Lee, have you been sued before? You can go to an OSHA website. You can ask them for an insurance rating. A number of very basic things that can be done that are not burdensome. In this case, it was admitted there was absolutely no inquiry or concern about the safety rating of this subcontractor. The only thing that mattered to Mr. Capano and Mr. Worrell was whether there was financial responsibility, which is a laudable goal, but shouldn't be the only thing, whether there was financial responsibility, and also whether they had the competency and the manpower to do the job. No consideration as to safety. In this case, had those questions been asked, the Lee case, the Gin case would have been fleshed out, and if that had occurred, we have testimony from Mr. Capano in the record that says he probably would not have hired this contractor. So there is a direct link up between having that information and what would have occurred if they had received it. So 411 is a very critical issue in terms of workplace safety. It kind of, like I mentioned to you, is interconnected with a contractor's need to take action and be more proactive in the site. If responsible contractors are hired, it's less likely that that will have to occur. The court, in reliance on Woolahan, was going much further than it needed to. There should not have been, in this case, an entry of summary judgment based on the rationale in Woolahan. Woolahan is a different set of facts. It deals with the landowner, and here, as I can see my time is up, we're dealing with totally different policy and totally different issues, legal issues involved. Thank you.
You do understand you went through your rebuttal time. So.
I do understand. Okay.
May it please the court, David Culley on behalf of Appellee Capenna Homes, Inc. I'd like to start with the voluntary assumption of implementing safety measures, that issue first. I want to respond to the point that Justice Ridgely made, and that is that the rule adopted by Delaware as recently as the Handler case and as early as the Figs versus Bellevue case, Superior Court decision, makes it clear that it is specific safety measures and or services that the general contractor or owner is obligated to have or is to have voluntarily assumed, not some general responsibility overall for the job site. I would suggest that all general contractors to one degree or another have a general interest in job site safety at their job sites. But unless you take on and assume the responsibility for implementing specific safety measures or services, which is the language used in Section 324 of the restatement, you have not breached that duty. So it is the specific measures that must be taken, not a general overall acceptance of responsibility for job site safety. Mr. LeWinter says
so
that there is
a safety harness would qualify as specific.
That's correct. And another good example would be in Handler. Handler is a perfect example of this because in Handler, you recall that the plaintiff fell from a walkway on the second floor into the foyer area. He was painting at the time. There was a safety guardrail or a railing that had been placed by the general contractor. General contractor supplied the lumber and the tools to have that implemented. He acknowledged that he had a responsibility for maintaining it. And he also acknowledged he had a responsibility for reinstalling it if it was removed by someone. So that is a perfect example of a general contractor who, at least there is evidence, a genuine issue of fact, as to whether or not he assumed that responsibility. The same would be true with a safety harness in this case. Mr. Winter says that there is evidence in the record to suggest that there is a genuine issue of material fact on this issue. I disagree. There were a few things mentioned. I want to make sure that I cover them. The first is, and this is a difficult issue, but the case law I would suggest is clear on this point. Notifying a subcontractor, and particularly the subcontractor's management, which is what occurred in this case, that the employees are not complying with some aspect of the contract, in this case, not complying with the OSHA regulation to use fall protection, is not a voluntary assumption of responsibility for that matter. The Bryant case, which is longstanding in Delaware, the Kilgore case, all of these cases take that position. Interestingly, too, the case law is clear that the right to terminate a subcontractor because they have failed to comply with some aspect of the contract, including OSHA regulations or safety issues. The case law, as universally, I know of no case that has rendered a contrary opinion, as universally said, that does not constitute a voluntary assumption of workplace responsibility. It's a difficult issue for the general contractor to be in. You've hired a subcontractor. You realize that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. You warn their management. You tell them that unless it changes, something will be done. And there's a lot of timing that's involved in this, too. And you don't know, of course, at that day or the next day that there's going to be an injury that occurs. So it's a difficult situation. I think that's why the courts have not adopted that as the rule. There were a couple of checklists that were mentioned in the briefing that Mr. Chambers used to walk around the job site in May and October of 2002. This accident happened in January of 2003. The case law, again, is clear. The Patton versus Simone case and the Bryant case, again, make it clear that the use of general inspections by themselves, unless they direct the subcontractor in his activities or it results in some implementation of some process for the safety of the roofers in this case, does not constitute a voluntary assumption of workplace safety. And then finally, there's been mention of the safety program. I want to make the point about that very clear. There was a safety program, a written document that's in the appendix, in the appellant's appendix, that was prepared by, written by Capano Homes insurance carrier in the year 2000. This accident happened in 2003. First, on its face, that safety program applies, is intended to apply to the employees at Capano Homes, not other subcontractors' employees. Secondly, there is no evidence in the record, never developed, that that safety program was ever implemented by Capano Homes at any job site, including the preserve where this accident occurred. And then finally, Bryant, again, I would suggest, in the Kilgore case, make it clear that having that kind of safety program prepared by an insurance company does not constitute a voluntary assumption of workplace safety. The last point I want to make about on this issue is, in the case of Lee versus Capano Builders, different entity altogether from my client, Chief Judge Sue Robinson for the Federal District Court wrote in that opinion that it would be perverse to punish a general contractor or an owner for taking steps to ensure that the subcontractor complies with the contract and with their safety obligations. In other words, it would be counterproductive, it would be counterintuitive, for that matter, to suggest that the general contractor not notify them of safety violations if they're observed.
Can I interrupt you?
Absolutely.
We've got a situation here where, as I understand the facts, it was either observed or reported to one of your client's supervisors that there was a problem with this subcontractor not having its people using safety harnesses, right?
Correct. That is correct.
And you're saying, if I understand correctly, that this is just kind of general job site supervision, and even if Capano had said to the subcontractor, you know, either you get your people to wear the safety harnesses or we're going to fire you, even if they had done that, and then there was an accident, that would not constitute sufficient involvement in safety, right?
That's
okay.
Our position.
So if I understand you correctly, the only way Capano gets pulled into this is if Capano said, here, take these safety harnesses. We've got safety harnesses, and we're giving them to your people. Put them on when you go up to the roof today. At that point, would you agree that Capano had undertaken some responsibility for safety?
I think the case law is clear that when a general contractor is in the position of supplying materials, tools, devices, I think the case law is clear that they have, there is an argument at least, an issue of fact, that they have voluntarily assumed responsibility for those employees' safety. And again, a good example of that is in one of the cases, one of the California Supreme Court cases actually cited by the appellant, where there was some equipment provided for the use of the subcontractors. I believe it was a forklift or something like that. And the subcontractor's employees were required to use that forklift, and it was faulty. That claim was allowed to go forward. That makes sense. It puts the general contractor in a very difficult position. I acknowledge that. But the case law is clear that the right to terminate in the contract. I suppose you could even have a situation where the facts develop such that the general contractor stepped in and in some manner, and I can't think of a situation off the top of my head, but in some manner negligently acted from that point forward or took some action at that point forward that really kind of stepped outside of his role, the role presented by the contract and the role presented by the relationship between the two. In that situation, that fact scenario, I suppose the general contractor could be said to have voluntarily assumed responsibility for those roofer safety, but that did not occur in this case.
Okay, and I interrupted you when you were talking about Judge Robinson's decision and how it would be perverse to impose liability on a general contractor for just supervising the job site and trying to maintain a safe work environment. Doesn't the flip side of that work just as well in terms of it would be perverse to have a situation where the general contractor is actually encouraged not to notice and not to step in because, gee, if I say something to this subcontractor and then there's an accident, I could have liability, whereas if I act like I don't know anything that's going on, I'm in better shape. How is that a good public policy?
It's, as I said, it's a difficult position for the general contractor to be in. You have to look at the situation. You have to weigh the circumstances. You don't want to encourage general contractors to just walk away from the situation. But on the other hand, it's clear from the case law that we have that the right to supervise and the right to notify the sub of these violations and the right even to terminate them, to take that step, have them go away from the job, get another contractor in, which is no small matter when you've got an ongoing project, happened once before in this case. Those things do not constitute the voluntary assumption of workplace safety. Case law has been consistent throughout for that.
I guess the better question, rather than the case law consistently maintains that, is why should it?
Well, because I think the general contractors, when they're dealing with subcontractors and they've got contracts that they put into place, and the contract places responsibility on the subcontractor to take care of their own employees, which is what this case is about. This is not a situation where there's some innocent bystander who's been injured.
I understand it.
Where their own, then I think the law properly puts on the subcontractor and has always placed on the subcontractor the responsibility for taking care of the safety of his own employees. Ultimately, that's what this case is about. This case is about, and I'll cite you a quotation from the Handler Corporation. I hope that this is responsive to your question. In Handler, this court said, and it's at page 743, 901 A. Second 743, court said, apologize. An owner or general contractor does not have a duty to protect an independent contractor's employees from the hazards of completing the contract. At the end of the day, the general contractor has a lot of things to be concerned about. One of the things that he is, in a general sense, concerned about, but should not be legally obligated to be concerned about, is the safety of the independent contractor's employees regarding hazards arising out of the very work that they were hired to complete. And I think that if I were to conclude my comments on both of these issues that we're dealing with today, that at the end of the day, that's what this case is about. So I guess my answer is that that's in the circumstances of this case. Now, if we were here talking about an innocent bystander situation, I think we'd be talking about something entirely different. But in this case, I think that's the answer. Okay. On the question of negligent selection, I found this to be a fascinating issue legally and intellectually, frankly, when this issue arose, because of the manner in which the jurisprudence has developed over the years. We know that since 1987, the lower courts of the state have acknowledged or recognized a cause of action for employees of the independent contractor under Section 411 of the Restatement. This court has never had the opportunity to consider that matter. Since 1987, there's been a substantial amount of jurisprudence in this area, not in Delaware, but elsewhere. And as you know from our brief, there has been an overwhelming majority of the courts that have considered this issue. And that's not my language. That's the exact quote from the California Supreme Court in the Camargo case. It basically said that the overwhelming majority of the courts that have considered this issue have not found there to be a cause of action for employees of the independent contractor against a general contractor or an owner under Section 411. Now, you can get into the discussion about the language, the specific words that are used in Section 411, the fact that it refers to third persons as opposed to all people, but that's not what my argument is today. I want to talk about the underlying principle behind that. And we get back again to the issue I just raised, and that is an independent contractor, a general contractor or an owner is not obligated, does not have a duty to protect the employees of an independent contractor from the hazards of completing the work. In the Willihan case, this court considered the same principle, I would submit, under Section 343, premises liability of the restatement. Two different groups of plaintiffs. As the court knows, the first group of plaintiffs were employees of an independent contractor on the landowner's property who was exposed to asbestos and allegedly injured because of the activities of their own work in completing the contract. They were on the site. They were exposed to asbestos because of the work they were doing. They were contracted to do. The second group of employees were employees of independent contractors who were on the premises who were not doing anything with asbestos but were exposed to asbestos and allegedly injured because of the activities of some other contractor. This court held that with regard to the first of those groups, and that's the situation we're dealing with in the Urena case. Again, an employee of the independent contractor where the hazard falling off a roof arises out of the very work that he was hired to do. This court found that they did not have a cause of action against the landowner, the homeowner, under Section 343. The trial judge in this case recognized that the policy considerations and the principle behind that is identical as between 343 and Section 411, because in both cases, the injury arose out of a hazard endemic or inherent in the work that the roofer was hired, the contractor was hired to perform. And this court cited a case by the name of Kinsman, which is another California Supreme Court decision, in the Willihan case. The Kinsman case, we did not take a lot of time to discuss in our brief, but I found it fascinating that there was a quotation from Kinsman that is directly on point, this point that I'm attempting to make. The court observed in Kinsman that when there is a hazard that can be addressed through reasonable safety precautions on the part of the independent contractor, here the use of a safety harness. And by the way, the plaintiff in this case had a safety harness. He owned one. It was in the van on the ground below him. When there is a hazard that can be addressed through reasonable safety precautions on the part of the independent contractor, the hirer is not liable to the contractor's employees if the contractor fails to do so. And that's exactly what happened in this case. So the decision that the Willihan case relied upon is in line with the Camargo case and the other cases that we cited in our brief on this issue. The jurisprudence, I would suggest, is completely separate, completely different from an issue where you had an innocent, again, third person, innocent bystander who was injured. But in this context, there should be no cause of action under Section 411 against the general contractor or the owner. And Justice Ridgely raised, I would submit, an important point that I want to emphasize, and that is if you apply Section 411 in the manner in which the plaintiff would have you apply it in this case, there is no reason, there is no logical or doctrinal reason why that same principle would not be applied to a homeowner who hired a carpenter or an HVAC contractor or a roofer, as in this case, to come in and do some work. It really extends. So you hire a roofer. Roofer comes to your home, brings three workers with him, and one of those workers falls off a roof. Should there be a cause of action against you under Section 411 for negligently hiring that roofer? We would submit that doesn't make any sense. The last point I want to make about this issue, the negligent selection issue, is even if you were to find that there is a cause of action on behalf of the plaintiff in this case under Section 411, There is no court in this nation that I've found, and there's been no citation from the other side on this issue, and I'm sure if there was, they would have cited it. There is no court in the nation that has required a general contractor to do any more than Capano Homes did in this case. Capano Homes knew that Rising Sun did roofing work. In fact, Mr. Worrell had contact with them years before when he worked for Carosi Homes. They called various contractors and roof supply companies and asked about them, and they were told about them. Actually, one of them was a roofing contractor that had been in litigation with Rising Sun before, and yet that was never mentioned to Mr. Worrell of Capano Homes. They required insurance and a license. In fact, Capano Homes was named as a certificate holder on the insurance certificate. And they also require that they comply with the safety regulations through the contract. No court has ever required a general contractor or an owner to do anything more than they did.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.